8 of 2003. I have a sponsor. She knows that she's my sponsor. And I sponsor women. I have a home group. It is the Tampa Young People's Group. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30 at the Portico Church in downtown Tampa. I've been seeing some of y'all there, so now I have a newfound respect after making that drive up here. And yeah, but we would love to have you make the trek. And we go out for pizza afterwards. It's, to me, the best pizza in Tampa, to Eddie and Sam's. And yeah, it's a great time. So I get very, very nervous. I think because I want to do such a good job, because Alcoholics Anonymous has really given me every single thing that is like good in my life. And I want to pay it reverence and do it justice. And I am just so humbled to be invited anywhere, really, but so humbled to be invited to speak with you guys. Lisa asked me in like October, so if she's y'all's speaker, no, maybe it was September. She is very on top of getting speakers for y'all, and the energy, I'll say, is like palpable in this room. I heard that y'all started like 5, 6, 7 months ago, this meeting, and like you can just feel the energy and like the vitality and like enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous in this room. I couldn't find you guys at first. I was like circling, and I saw like this church and people standing outside, and I was like, oh, thank God. I think that's the place. So I'll start how I always start. I was born and raised in Miami-Dade County to two parents who wanted me desperately. And for someone like me, that is like so gross and annoying, you know? My mom had tried for over a decade to have a baby, and kept having miscarriage after miscarriage, then tried to adopt, was told because she was 40 that she was too old, because it was the early 80s. And then she got pregnant with me. I was a NICU baby. So from day one of life, I was just sucking the finance and the emotions out of my parents. And I have this sweating disorder. It's called hyperhidrosis. When I was a kid, it was very, very bad. It really only gets like this when I am speaking. But most of the time, it's pretty under control. And my very first resentment was in the second grade. We used to have to do this thing in school, really annoying, called cursive writing. I'm sure a lot of the kids didn't have to do that right now. But yeah, we would have to write on these pieces of paper, and Mrs. Gelfand would take my papers up to the front of the room and clip them at the front of the room with clothespins so that they could dry, because my papers were so soaked, she didn't want to touch them. And that was my first resentment. I was like, how dare she, you know? Like, I have a medical condition. Like, she's disgusting. And so, of course, my mom thought it would be a great idea for me to play competitive piano with these hands. And so I would play these pieces, and between every song someone would have to come and wipe down the piano. And it was so embarrassing. I just remember like grimacing, bracing myself, waiting for the noise, being like, oh my God, I just wanted to like crawl into a hole and die. My parents are both very straight-laced, type A, loving, caring, like kind of like old hippie type people. It was very structured in my house. It was, I have a younger sister who's 17 months younger. She came immediately following me. And not a lot of love in my house, I will say, because my mom is from the western mountains of Appalachia in North Carolina. And my father was a Marine. His father was a Marine. His father was a Marine. And they're, you know, they're older. So they're now, my dad is almost in his mid-80s. And my mother is 80 years old. So they're just from a different generation, right? Like, you don't really talk about your feelings. You need to self-actualize. If you have a problem, you need to, like, don't gripe about it. Pull yourself up. You know, like, this is what they saw their parents do. So I heard a lot about that. I remember just feeling like I was an alien in this family. Like, did I get switched at birth? Like, why do I have all of these feelings and they're so big and I'm just not okay? And I remember being on the playground at school and just like staring at these kids in like disbelief. Like, how are they so inwardly organized and talking to each other and using their hands in the right way and like connecting with one another? I felt like they got this memo that I was just not privy to. Like, they knew how to conduct themselves, and I just felt like I did not have this like guidebook that they had. And I was like very much so ready to take my first drink, you know, and if I would have known what alcohol was to do for me, I promise you I would have been like taking it out of the bottle at like 3-4 years old. And I like my baba, and I just like could not, you know, I just, life was so overwhelming for me, and I didn't have anything wrong. You know, like, I was in a safe, good home, you know, and I wouldn't have told you that when I came in here. Like, I would have, I had all of these stories and things of, like, why I drank the way I drank. And I started being sexually abused when I was 10 years old. I had begged my family to go to this church down the street from my house with these other girls in my neighborhood, and I just like wanted that connection to something bigger than myself so desperately. And I my parents, like, my mom grew up with like hellfire and brimstone. My dad said he was a recovering Catholic, so they didn't want my sister or I like brought up with this judging type entity. And which is nice, you know, but I wanted some sort of connection. So I go to this church, and there was this youth pastor there who immediately took an interest in me. I was a heavy kid, you know, I was over 100 pounds by the time I was in second grade. I don't weigh that much more than that now. I had, my parents slapped braces on me. Because I was a freak of nature and started teething when I was 2 months old. And so by the time I was in second grade, I had full face braces. I had these Coke bottle glasses, and you know, I'm heavy, and I just was not okay. Like, I have this sweating disorder, and I'm like this oily, sweaty mess, you know, and I'm getting bussed 3 days a week to go to the, like the gifted program. Like, I'm like, nerd alert, like that's me, you know, it still is. But I really like, when I started getting sexually abused, for me, it was like, it confirmed what I already knew, like deep down at my core, that like I was shameful. Something was wrong with me. I knew I couldn't tell my peers the things that I was doing because they would think I was disgusting too. And being sexually molested, sexually assaulted, that like doesn't make me an alcoholic. But I will tell you that through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and getting outside help that I have been able to find freedom from that. And I have been able to transform those experiences that happened in, you know, from 10 to 12 years old into some of my greatest assets and treasures. And like, those are the incredible things that come to pass here. And those things, I can say them, you know, not like that it doesn't affect you, because you continue to live with those things and those traumas that happen to us, you know, when we're children, and also when we're qualifying and trying to get into these rooms, trying to get our seat here. It never goes away, but like, we become uniquely qualified to help another alcoholic. And so, you know, I got offered the chance to drink with a girl in my neighborhood, Stephanie. She was so cool, y'all. She did gymnastics and she was like so blonde and so skinny. And she invited me to go drinking with her, and there was this trailer park like outside of Pinecrest, which I know you guys don't know Miami, but like, now it is like a very well-to-do area. When I was growing up, it was, I mean, I was walking to the trailer park, okay? So and I, you know, we walk to this trailer park and go to this quick stop, and there's this guy named Wolfman there, and I had been doing some like bad stuff, right? Like bad for my family, which isn't that bad. Like sneaking down the busway and like getting on the metro rail and going downtown without telling my parents, you know? And and on one of my adventures, I had seen this guy and he was like really cool. He had a skateboard and he was wearing all black. And he had like chains hanging, you know, like it is like the mid 90s, right? So like, he has the chains and the JNCOs and like, so cool. And he had this like glimmering bottle that just like, I was transfixed by it. And it was like the prettiest color of orange. It looked like candy. And I was like, and I saw it in the store that day. It was MD 2020, the orange Jubilee. And like I said, like, I have alcoholism on both sides of my family. You shake a you know, my family tree and bottles do fall out. But my parents, I never saw my parents drunk. My parents really wanted different for my sister and myself. And so I just never saw that. But I intuitively knew that you were supposed to turn that bottle back and up and drink it as fast as you could, you know, and that's what I did. And you guys, I got that special effect that day produced by alcohol. And I had a spiritual experience that day, you know, like one day to the next, my life was forever changed by that experience. And it was like instantly I was okay. I knew how to speak and make jokes and be in the moment. And I could like, my sweating, it didn't matter. I was cool and I was okay. And it's amazing, because Alcoholics Anonymous, when I am going to meetings, when I'm saying yes to AA, when I'm working with a sponsor, when I'm sticking my hand out to the newcomer, it does that same special effect. It produces it for me today. And I promise you, after 22 years, like, if it did not do that for me, because I have a very big and full life today because of this program. Like, I go one thing to the next all day long, and I love living life like that. Like, I love to be busy and useful. And I would not still be here, you know, if I did not get that relief and I did not get that special effect. But Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys, it can be really annoying sometimes with like how slow that effect takes to come. Like you have to be these words that I truly hate as an alcoholic, like disciplined, diligent, and consistent. Like I just want, you know, but that drink that day, that in those seconds, like boom, it got me there right away, got me downtown right then and there. And you know, like my drinking career, because I was 11 years old right before my 12th birthday when I had that MD 2020, and like, you know, I got sober when I was 19. So my drinking career is not like spectacular. Like I'm spectacularly a bad drunk, you know, but you can say I definitely tried, right? Like, 'cause I did, I really tried. And I started having consequences really early on. I was in my first outpatient treatment when I was 13 years old. I got court ordered to you people when I was 13 years old. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to this group. It was a young people's group off of Ponce de Leon and US 1 in 1998-1999. And you know, you could smoke inside then, so that was extremely attractive to someone like me. And there were all these kids there, but they to me were really old. They were like 19, 20 years old, and I felt like I wasn't totally like them. I didn't see anyone as young as I was at that time, and they would all say things to me like, oh, we probably spilled more than you've ever drank, which might have been true, you know, and like, you're so cute. Like I was really cute when I was 13 and bad. But you know, I felt like in those first couple meetings, and I was also so self-centered, right? Because I'm not only 13 years old, but I have alcoholism. So that's like a special kind of self-centeredness. that I thought my dad had gone to the meeting ahead of me and told these people like what was in my diary and things to say to like connect with me. And I'm insane, right? Like this is my keen alcoholic mind at work. That these people are sharing at me, but really they're just speaking this language of the heart that I am connecting so deeply and truly with. And they're armed with facts about themselves that like cuts through everything. Like the power of identification that we get here from Alcoholics Anonymous it's incredible. And it's one of our greatest assets that we get here. And so they are speaking, and I think they've read my diary, and I can't understand why I'm relating to these people. I felt like I was so different and unique and troubled. And by this point, like I've been going to psychiatrists and psychologists since I was in like third, fourth grade, trying to figure out what is the problem with me. And I have all these diagnoses slapped onto me, which, you know, BPD and bipolar disorder or this, and I would look these diagnoses up in these things called books. We don't need those anymore. And just read about them so I could know how I was supposed to be acting. Like, I just wanted, like, something to tell me, like, okay, be like this. Okay. I can do that, right? And it's wild, but like I get that here today too. Like I get a design for living here. My sponsor doesn't tell me things I have to do, but she like gives me well-researched suggestions on you know, things I can or cannot do with some success. And so I, you know, I'm relating to these meetings, but I'm like, I don't know. I'm still too young, and alcohol is absolutely my solution. So when I don't drink, like, my life gets worse and I get worse. And these defects of character are just, like, so pronounced because I have no solution. Like, when I, even today, like, when I am out of sorts, haven't been to a meeting, am so busy, like, burning the candle on both ends, working, you know, I work a lot of jobs. It's a problem. I should really cut back. But I, when I'm not taking care of my sobriety and myself, like, it becomes glaringly apparent in a matter of days, you know, that I am off the beam and not well. So, you know, this teenage girl who has alcohol as this new solution, when I'm sober, like, I don't have a drinking problem. Like, I have a sober problem. Like, I'm not okay when I am sober. So, and I'm, like, a blackout drinker. I'm Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Like, I seem like a really sweet girl. I know, like, I can clean up and look real nice, but, like, I am belligerent. I am nasty. I am, like, the only words I know are four-letter ones and bro, you know? And I, like, I for some reason think I'm from, like, a very hard family. When I get intoxicated, and that's, like, so far from the truth. Like, I am delusional. And, you know, I was a chameleon. Like, I, one week I'm, like, hanging out, going to hip hop shows and sneaking off to South Beach, to, like, be in the club underage. And, you know, it, with all these, like, hip hop heads and hip-hop crowds, and I'm wearing, like, the cool sneakers and whatever, and then the next week I'm goth, and then the next week I'm, like, a skater, but I'm just wherever the booze is where I'm at. And I, like I said, I'm already in this outpatient, and I meet, like, these other degenerate children there, who just taught me how to, like, hide my drinking much better. And they showed me this spy store in the mall. Like, do people even go to the mall anymore? But, like, we went in the 90s. We're at the mall. And there was this spy store, and you could, like, hide stuff in your walls and cut holes. And, you know, I just thought I was so, such an engineer, right? And I am learning to, like, be more secretive and better with hiding the things that I'm doing. And I'm getting kicked out of middle school, and I'm in high school, and it's just the same stuff, you know. I stole my mom's car when I was 15 to go get alcohol with my friends down from, there was this FINA about 11 miles from my house in Coconut Grove. And as the resourceful alcoholic that I was, like, I would devise a plan of, like, how I could get there to get the booze. And and so I stole my mom's car. I didn't understand you couldn't turn left in front of oncoming traffic. I didn't really know, like, traffic laws yet. And I just, you know, T-bone her Chrysler minivan into this oncoming traffic. And my mom, being the burgeoning Al-Anon member that she would become, comes to the scene and says that she was driving, because my mom is like an angel, really. She and she thought she was doing, you know, she didn't understand, like, enabling and things like that. So she's just saying, oh, you know, I was driving. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. I wasn't paying attention. And I get my license 2 weeks later, and I create a 6-car pileup, inebriated at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, cutting class on South Beach again, at, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I didn't get breathalyzed. I said I was changing my CD player. Like, I'm so old. I'm changing my CD changer. I was trying to change Britney out for Limp Bizkit, and and I dropped the CD, and I created a 6-car pileup on US-1, and I realized, like, that day what my problem really was. Driving. Driving. So I had this hostage, poor guy, still one of my dearest friends. His name was Javier. And one of the things I would say when I came in here, I'm not like you people. I never had a DUI, But poor Javier had 3 with me passenger side. And because from that moment on, he always had to drive. And I just kept going, I kept going into these blackouts, and I really had a lot of well-meaning, wonderful people around me when I was in Miami. It wouldn't be the case when I would leave, that would keep me out of very serious, when I was so drunk that I would be blacked out and passed out, they would put me in a safe place and take care of me and hold my hair when I was throwing up and do all of those things. I also had adults who were rallying for me and trying to get me to just graduate high school, and I was just spitting in their faces. I was so entitled and didn't know how good I had it. And I just fast forward, because it's all the same throughout high school for me. I'm just having encounters with the police. I was arrested 4 times as a juvenile, and at the age of 18, which was my senior year of high school, because I was held back, so I was the oldest one in my class. And when I was about to graduate, I ended up getting arrested for the 3rd time as an adult. And all of my charges are alcohol related. I was in a blackout for this is my second. Javier and I went into a 25-foot ditch on Alligator Alley. And the police officer that dove down into this ditch to see if we were okay, I assaulted him, punched him, and kicked and screamed, and got my stomach pumped in the back of an EMS. Came to in Collier County Women's, which I don't know if you guys know, but Miami is really far from Marco Island, Collier County. I don't know what I was doing there, but I was there. And there was, there was alcohol, so that's why I was there. And I assault this police officer and come to, and these women in this facility are all standing around me, and I'm what's going on? And they're girl, you were wild and you were kicking and screaming and you're so tiny, but you're just belligerent. And I'm oh my God, they think I'm really cool. And these are my people, these are my best friends, right? And this bigger, blonder version of me takes me into her cell and puts Skittles on my lips and takes this pen and puts it under my eyes. And she's later we can get pills. And I'm who would ever leave this place? They're feeding me, I have a schedule, I like that, and I do really well with that. And so when my mom comes to bail me out of this Collier County Women's facility, general population, because the police were trying to scare me straight, because Javier did not get put in general population of the men's jail. I'm like, you can't take me away. Like, these are my best friends, you know? I can't tell you not one of their names, but they're my best friends. And that next night, I steal poor Clara's car and pick up Javier because he has to drive. And we get into this high-speed chase on I-95 with this man we were having a disagreement with about owing him money for stuff we had bought from him or whatever. And so we try to get off the exit. We get off the exit a little too fast and we like hop the curb and we hit a pole and the pole falls on top of the car and then arrested again. And, you know, so that was my third arrest. My parents had retained this attorney for me who was saying these things to me now that he had never said before about, like, mandatory jail time, three strikes in the state of Florida, blah, blah, blah. And I remember just my entitlement was palpable, you know, like, girls like me don't. Come on, Doug. Girls like me don't go to jail. Right. And I have since, through Alcoholics Anonymous and H&I commitments, met girls much bougier than me and more entitled than me who absolutely do go to jail. You know, but the judge that I went in front of, she told me to show up like looking like Alice in Wonderland. I took that note. I wore blue dress, white headband, and to, you know, my hearing that day, and she told me that I was suffering from an alcohol and substance use disorder and that she was going to mandate 1 year of treatment. And I remember thinking like my life was over. And like she had just done me such a favor. And so I go into this treatment program in Miami. It wasn't fair. There was like a Spanish program there. And me and Spanish men, like, I just can't. And I couldn't focus at all. So I end up getting kicked out of there. But I'm still on this court order, so I have to go somewhere. So I get sent to an all-women's facility in Goshen Springs, Mississippi, where you cut grass with scissors. And at the time, it was like one of my biggest achievements. I was the youngest person they had ever let into this facility, and I wanted all of you to know that I got let in, and I was the youngest. You know, like, what an accolade. And I was that girl who I absolutely robbed my parents of the ability to brag and boast about me. All these kids that I'm growing up around they're going to Harvard, they're going to Columbia, they have lacrosse scholarships, like they are doing incredible things with their lives. And you know, my mom is a member of this like women's organization that does philanthropic things. And like, she's twiddling her thumbs being like, well, Rachel's in drug court again, you know, like she might be about to graduate. We don't know though, but we're hopeful. And, and it was, you know, I see those things like through working a fourth step and giving a fifth step to a sponsor, like I'm able to see like who and what I truly am and like the causes and conditions and of the shame of why I continue to pour alcohol into my body and why if I do not have a psychic change, we will always, do you guys know that? Like we will always drink again. We will always drink again, okay? Like, no amount of sobriety ensures that sobriety thing. No, I mean, it helps. Like, it's kind of like autopilot for me some days, right? Like, I have my meetings I regularly attend. I have these girls that call me. Like, I'm pretty much in the middle of the boat in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I say yes when people ask me to do things. But like when I stop and I backslide, it is like I have a brain, like I am hardwired to put substances into me again. So I don't know why I'm saying that, but. And I am in this treatment center in Jackson, Mississippi. I overhear the therapeutic team talking about this guy who's like toxic to the therapeutic community. My little ears perk right up because like sounds like boyfriend material to me. So I get a note over a moat, you know, resourceful female alcoholic that I am. And we meet up under the Mississippi moonlight and decide we are in love, you know, and I was, right? And we decide to leave together AMA. And I set out to prove that I could drink like a normal person because these other substances, like they're a problem, right? Like they're addictive. But alcohol, like, you can't say I'm so, like, I just rationalized and I was not an alcoholic. And my mom, like, I'd be like, Mom, and am I an alcoholic? She'd be like, no. I'd be like, thank you. Like, how? You know, I'm so young. I've never tried to really stop or moderate. And so, you know, now I am in Mississippi, you know, setting out to drink normally, whatever that is, that I've never done it. Just so you know, never had any desire to drink normally, have one or two or like sip. I mean, when you're drinking MD 2020 out of the bottle or Mickey's warm out of the bottle, like it's not in the cards for you to be sipping a martini at a bar on a bar stool. You know what I mean? Like I drink out of plastic bottles, so in paper bags, like from the beginning. So I set out to like prove these other things were an issue, but I'm gonna abstain from those and I'm just gonna make it real easy and just drink normal. And I my parents started going to this really annoying place by this time called Al-Anon, and I'm calling them and asking for money, and they're saying things that sound crazy to me, like, we are detaching from you with love, we love you, we are not going to continue to support you when you are killing yourself, hanging up. I am like your firstborn who you tried for years, like, all I hear my whole life is, I'm a miracle, and I'm like, I'm your first daughter. Like, what? And I was shocked. And so I'm in Mississippi. I thought this guy that I was with was like very simple, right? Because I'm from a big city and he's from like nowhere, Mississippi. And I got to learn very quickly that like I didn't know anything. You know, I am like doing things for that next drink that I had never had to do before in Miami. I am around people, places, and things that are my bottom is just getting lower and lower. I'm hanging out in hotels that are connected to bars that will serve alcohol to minors. And then you can just go up to the hotel after, if you guys get what I'm saying. Like, it is seedy, it is nasty. And I just accepted it, you know, like, okay, well, if this is what I have to do to drink, then so be it. So be it. And so I'm getting money from this guy, from multiple guys at this time, so that I can get my hair, nails, and tan, like I am so accustomed, right? While I'm doing all these other things. And this one guy, Larry, he had fallen on very hard times. I'd met him in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was not doing well. And he, I ended up moving him in with Michael and I. So we were just like one really messed up, dysfunctional family. And Larry would say these really dark things to me, man. And like the signs were there, but like I'm this self-absorbed 19-year-old girl. And, you know, he ended up shooting himself in the head, and I found him dead in his room. And I remember like when I found him and seeing the peace on his face, and like I related to Larry on that level that we as alcoholics who identify with one another relate to each other on. And when I saw his face, I just thought, lucky. Because I knew like all this like committee that is constantly chattering and ripping and like going, it was like silent. Like I could see it. And I like wanted that. But I was like too much of a coward for myself. And how dark it is before the dawn. You know, that was August 11th of 2003. I had no idea that my last sobriety date was like right there on the horizon, you know? And I was going to meetings still, you know, I would pick up white chips. I picked up so many white chips in these 18 months, y'all. it was like embarrassing. I felt like I could feel like when I would like go get a white chip that people would be like, "Aw, like her again, like ugh, like she never does anything different." And so I had gotten like 5 days sober during this time, and this one little stint, and you know, resourceful female alcoholic, I get into college in those 5 days, get the application done, which it is Mississippi, so it's not that impressive, but I did get into college. And I had told Michael, my boyfriend, that, you know, that it started on the 25th, and that it was really important that I be there on the first day of school. And like he respected my hopes, dreams, aspirations, not whatsoever, like not at all. And so we got drunk, you know, the night before I was to go to school, and I got blackout drunk. I went into a blackout. I lost my car. Well, might as well. I wrecked my car, and ended up with this rental car, which then got given to a crack dealer. And it, you know, I knew that I could get to school that next day, but I rather just like call people and tell them that I gave, you know, these people had my car, that it was a rental car and I didn't know what to do, and like help me get out of this and go across the street to the gas station. It was like an Amoco, where I would beg people to buy me booze because I was 19 and could not legally buy alcohol. And I was miserable at this point. I'm drinking vodka out of the freezer in the morning at this point. And I'm like wanting to just, I remember thinking like, girls like me don't get sober. Girls like me are not mothers. Like I'm just having these thoughts that are like very, very dark, and I felt so lonely because I could not see my life with or without alcohol at all. And I ended up going to that, finally getting to school on the third day of school, and I missed the day class, but I made that night class. And I was right on time because my God, he is always right on time. And I walk into the class and some girl raises her hand right off the bat and says, "Dr. Grummel, what's your favorite kind of wine?" And he says, "I don't drink, I'm allergic to alcohol." And that's all I heard that whole class, you know? And it was American government class, and I'm supposedly from America, but I'm from Miami, Florida. So I seriously, it's wild. And I don't understand anything that's going on. And but I understood that. So I go up to him after the class and I'm like, I've been out of school for like 18 months. And by the way, how allergic to alcohol are you? And he put down a 14-year medallion. He was ancient, so old. He was like 34. And he told me, this is how, you know, I got sober when I was 19. I was in a head-on collision, and my best friend was in the car and died instantly. I had just had this experience with Larry, finding Larry dead, and I related to him, and I went to a meeting that night called the Way Out Group in Jackson, Mississippi, and I'd picked up white chips there before. I picked up one there that night, and I don't know, I just had this like little shed of willingness, like, that was shining into my life, and I choose to call it God now. I didn't for a long time in here, and you know, I really evaded that part in the book that talks about like the purpose of this book. I didn't know, y'all. You don't know until you know. And sometimes it takes years to really know. So, like, I went through, I was sober physically. I had worked the steps to the best of my ability, but I had group of drunks as my God. And, like, for a drunk of my variety, like, that's just not big enough. I wish it was, you know, but, like, I found myself at 6 years suicidal. I got dumped. I've been dumped so many times sober, y'all. If anyone just got dumped, it's gonna be okay. It's okay. Like, you will love again. It's meant for you. But I got dumped, you know, and I attempted suicide. I tried to hang myself from a bedpost, and that was my solution, because I knew I couldn't drink. Like, I had a strong step one, but I couldn't see how I was gonna live without this person. And I get shipped back to Miami, and I meet this lady in this meeting that I begrudgingly go to because they're not doing it right in Miami, Florida AA. Like, I want my Mississippi AA, you know. And I talked to this lady after the meeting, and she told me, for a girl like me, it was a non-negotiable for me to invite a God to run my life, if I believed in him or not. And I don't know why, but I heard her, and I did it, finally, you know. And I do believe that I was on my way out if I would not have invited that higher power into my life to run my life. And I met these like young people at that time that were just on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. They were talking about starting a young people's group, and we ended up starting Miami YPG. Not anything I had planned or would ever want to do, ever. Especially at that point, I was way too cool. Like, so cool that I was about to be away from you guys. Like, that cool, you know? Like, isolatingly cool. I don't know if anyone suffers from that affliction, but it is quite lonely to be that cool. And I got it. That's the first time I really got in and jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous completely and abandoned myself to this program. And I've just been swept up ever since that time, and my life has continued to unfold. I had some major setbacks this last year. I went through a divorce. The common thread is that, like, AA continues to be there, and I just, like, continue to do the same stuff that kept me sober. I was this girl who took money from men and, like, prostituted myself for that next drink, and, like, today I support two households, and I say that not because, like, oh, I'm so great, but, like, it's a freaking miracle. It's a freaking miracle. And my son goes to a good school. I was told I couldn't have a child. Fast forward, I have this, like, three-year-old boy who is, like, the light of my life. And I'll close with this. Like, I had this chip just, like, sitting on my table. And it was like this angel, this sponsee of mine from North Florida had sent it to me for my anniversary this year. And my son saw it and he's like, Mommy, what's that? And I'm like, oh, that's Mommy's medallion. And he said, oh, I know, Mommy. My mommy is a miracle. He's three. And he just like says these things that like shock me on a daily basis. And like, I really would have given it all away, and I could have missed it all if not for this fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I got. Sorry, I talk so much about being drunk.